The nonprofit is the largest volunteer network in New York City. It offers thousands of volunteer opportunities with nonprofits and schools in all five boroughs. Thanksgiving volunteers are needed with organizations that address issues like hunger, homelessness, educational inequity, and the environment. For more information, go to their website, newyorkcares.org. And the annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade starts at 9 a.m. on Thursday, November 24th. Enjoy balloons, marching bands, floats, clowns, performances.
And we'll leave it right there because we already know that the parade has happened. It came, it went, just like life. With that said, the previous program was Driving Forces, which is heard Thursdays at 5 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!, followed by the Chris Hedges Report. It is 6 p.m.
This is Democracy Now!
So the first Thanksgiving story is begins with the Pequot Massacre by members of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which really marks sort of, in my opinion, marks sort of the mythology of the United States as a settler colonial country founded on sort of genocide to create, ironically, peace.
Our history is the future. As the nation marks Thanksgiving, we speak to the indigenous scholar and activist Nick Estes. Then, the myth of normal, trauma, illness, and healing in a toxic culture. We'll talk to acclaimed Canadian physician Gabor Maté.
When you isolate people, atomize them, you make them feel guilty or weak for their illness and tell them to get over their trauma. You're just shaming them more, you're isolating them more, and you're entrenching them more in the traumatic imprint. What people need is community, contact, compassion, safety.
All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this special broadcast, we begin the show with the indigenous scholar and activist Nick Estes. He's co-founder of the indigenous resistance group The Red Nation and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. His books include Our History is the Future, which tells the history of indigenous resistance over two centuries, offering a roadmap for collective liberation and a guide to fighting life-threatening climate change. Estes centers this history in the historic fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. I asked him to talk about the two Thanksgiving stories he writes about at the beginning of his book.
So the first Thanksgiving story is begins with the Pequot Massacre by members of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which really marks sort of, in my opinion, marks sort of the mythology of the United States as a settler colonial country founded on sort of genocide to create, ironically, peace. And then I begin with another story of a prayer march that we led in the Bismarck Mall in Bismarck, North Dakota, to kind of bring attention to the Standing Rock struggle during a Black Friday shopping event, which was met by police armed with AR-15s, who then began punching and kicking water protectors who were holding a prayer in the Bismarck Mall. And I thought it was a really kind of jarring sort of contrast between the past and the present, to say that while there are sort of differences between the massacre of Pequots in Massachusetts to the contemporary sort of fight against an oil pipeline, nonetheless, Bismarck North Dakota is a 90% white community that originally the Dakota Access Pipeline was supposed to go upriver from, but then was rerouted downriver to disproportionately affect the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. And disproportionate is the language that the Army Corps of Engineers use, as if there's ever a proportionate risk to environmental issues and water contamination. So at this particular moment, there weren't any actions that were happening in the camps, and it was largely at a standstill. And I think at that Thanksgiving weekend, there was an un-Thanksgiving feast that was held in the camps, and it was actually the highest point of the camps themselves, in the sense that there were the most sort of water protectors had showed up. So I thought it was a good kind of contrast to show that this history, you know, is a continuing history of genocide, of settler colonialism, and basically the founding myths of this country.
Your book's last words are, "We're challenged not just to imagine, but to demand the emancipation of Earth from capital. For the Earth to live, capitalism must die." Explain.
So that line is part of, you know, this longer section on liberation. And I think when we think about climate change, oftentimes the question of climate change really centers on market-driven solutions, such as, you know, green capitalism, and how do we create markets that sort of incentivize transition to sustainable economies, right? And I think really what we're kind of like beating around the bushes is that it's the system of capitalism that led us into this economic crisis to begin with. It's the sort of designation of certain populations in certain territories as disposable that has led us into our current epoch of global climate change. And so when we talk about who's going to bear the most burden when we transition, you know, out of the carbon economy, it most likely is going to be those populations that have historically been colonized. You know, and you know what's happening in Southeast Africa is a perfect example of why we need to transition away from not just the carbon economy, but capitalist economies in general. Because if we look at the history of how Africa has been a resource colony for Europe and for North America, we can look internally in the United States and understand that indigenous nations continue to serve as resource colonies for the United States, whether it's the Navajo Nation, where I'm living right now, that is producing oil and coal to generate electricity for the Southwest region, or whether it's the Fort Berthold Reservation up in North Dakota, that is, you know, the ground zero for oil and gas development in the Bakken region. We have to understand that indigenous nations have largely been turned into resource colonies and sites of sacrifice for not just the United States, but for the oil and gas industry. And so we need to not just think beyond climate change and putting carbon into the atmosphere, but we actually need to think about the system, the social system, right, that created those conditions in the first place. And so capitalism is fundamentally a social relation. It's a profit-driven system, whereas indigenous sort of ways of relating is one about reciprocity and mutual sort of respect, not just with the human, but also with the non-human world. And we're undergoing, you know, the sixth massive extinction event, which is caused by not just climate change, but is caused by capitalist sort of systems and the profit-driven sort of motive of our current economic and social system.
Nick Estes, you focus on seven historical moments of resistance in your new book, Our History is the Future. You say they form a historical roadmap for collective liberation. How did you choose these histories? Just quickly take us through them.
Sure. So I begin at the camps. I begin in the present, you know, at Standing Rock. And then I go to the fur trade with the first U.S. invasion, which was Lewis and Clark, who trespassed through our territory and were stopped by our leadership. And then I go through the Indian Wars of the 19th century and the Buffalo Genocide. And then I go into talking about the damming of the Missouri River in the mid 20th century, and then looking at red power in the 1960s and the 1970s, and how all of these indigenous people who were relocated because their lands were flooded by these dams eventually found themselves and created sort of the modern indigenous movement known as Red Power, and then going back and ending actually at Standing Rock in 1974 with the creation of the International Indian Treaty Council, which really coalesced these generations of indigenous resistance and took the treaties, the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, to the world and to the United Nations. And to do that, they looked to Palestinians, they looked to the South African anti-apartheid movement, who provided the mechanisms for recognition of indigenous rights at the United Nations. And that all resulted over four decades in the touchstone document, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was passed by the UN in 2007. And so in many ways, when we look at Standing Rock and we go down Flag Row and we see the hundreds of tribal nation flags that were represented in 2016 and 2017, we also saw the Palestinian flag that was there, kind of hearkening back to that international solidarity with movements of the global south, and specifically our Palestinian relatives who, you know, today are still facing, much like us, are still facing the brunt and the brutality of settler colonialism, whether it's the United States recognizing the annexation of the Golan Heights, or whether it's, you know, here in North America and the continued dispossession of indigenous territory and rights. We can see that settler colonialism in Israel or in Palestine is really an extension of settler colonialism in North America. And then I end, you know, with back at the camps and looking at how these camps really provided, you know, I actually look at a physical map that was handed out to water protectors who came to the camp. And on that map, there was, you know, where to find food, where to find the clinics, right, and where to find the security, and all the camps that were represented at the at Standing Rock, and to me that provided, you know, a kind of interesting parallel to the world that surrounded the camps, which was 92 different law enforcement jurisdictions. You had the North Dakota National Guard, the world of cops, the world of the militarized sort of police state, and in the camps themselves, you had sort of the primordial sort of beginnings of what a world premised on indigenous justice might look like. And in that world, you know, everyone got free food. There was a place for everyone, you know, the housing, you know, obviously was transient housing and teepees and things like that. But then also there was health clinics to provide health care, alternative forms of health care to everyone. And so if we look at that, it's housing, education, all for free, right? A strong sense of community. And for a short time, there was free education at the camps, right? Those are things that most poor communities in the United States don't have access to, and especially reservation communities. But given the opportunity to create a new world in that camp centered on indigenous justice and treaty rights, society organized itself according to need and not to profit. And so where there was, you know, the world of settlers, settler colonialism that surrounded us, there was the world of indigenous justice that existed for a brief moment in time. And in that world, instead of doing to settler society what they did to us, genociding, removing, excluding, there's a capaciousness to indigenous resistance movements that welcomes in non-indigenous peoples into our struggle, because that's our primary strength, is one of relationality, one of making kin, right?
Nick Estes, indigenous scholar and activist, speaking in 2019. His books include Our History is the Future. He's co-founder of the indigenous resistance group, the Red Nation, and a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. When we come back, Dr. Gabor Mate on the myth of normal, trauma, illness, and healing in a toxic culture.
Snow Goonie from the boonies, not the type you see in movies. Felt the spirit living through me since I was a puny dookie. Nietzsche, looky, looky, how I get low when I boogie. Don't mind me, some goody goodies. I'm Nate and Bougie. My wifey be the wolf, and I'm the wolf that's from the sea. And she no Pocahontas, more like Buffy, save Marie. Come do your dance with me. I do.
dip, you dip, we dip. No, it ain't blasphemy. I sip, you sip, we sip with Nisi cut. I stand and rock with all my suit without the boosters. Me and bro came out the womb. Nietzsche 1 and Nietzsche 2. We very indigenous people. We some VIPs. I'm a blood thicker than Unikin Grease. Nietzsche, please sing your song. This my jam. Got my fam all going ham for the land, not the gram. Stay Vinay, it's who I am. We choose copper over gold. Praise the elders. I remember what I'm told. Never turn your back on home. We them bougie natives. I got turquoise on my red. We them bougie natives. Five rings up on my fist. We them bougie natives. Big hat with the brim. We them bougie natives. Got that custom made bling. We them bougie natives. New city, new sweet grass, new sage. We them bougie natives. Pour my knowledge in my brain. We them bougie natives. New city, new sweet grass, new sage. We them bougie natives. You can holler at my name.
Hey, a ho.
Hey, a ho.
Can't you tell them woke? The smoke shop is closed. Can you tell your boys dope? Man, I'm spinning like I made it, and I'm smudging cause I'm broke again. Always running late. I hope the
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this Democracy Now! Special, we turn now to Dr. Gabor Maté, the acclaimed Canadian physician and author, just out with a new book, The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. Dr. Maté's worked for decades in Vancouver as a family physician, palliative care director, addiction clinician, and observer of human health. In a moment, we'll speak to Dr. Gabor Maté. But first, I want to turn to a trailer of a documentary about his work titled The Wisdom of Trauma.
In the U.S., the richest society in history, fully half of the citizens have a chronic disorder such as high blood pressure or diabetes. Anxiety amongst young people is growing rapidly. Asthma and autoimmune diseases are on the rise, as are addictions.
Depression is rising. Youth suicide is rising.
All is not well.
I started heroin at 26. That's what really destroyed me. It just takes the pain away.
It's easy to want to escape reality completely instead of coping with it.
And so the question is, can we be human beings in the midst of civilization? Because what we call civilization demands the denial of human needs.
Please welcome Dr. Gabor Maté.
Every human being has a true, genuine, authentic self. And the trauma is that disconnection from it, and the healing is the reconnection with it. Why do we get disconnected? Because it's too painful to be ourselves.
So you sort of a bit like in The Matrix, when Neo sees everything's made out of numbers. You look at people and you see all their trauma and damage.
That's what I see. So trauma is not the bad things that happen to you, but what happens inside you as a result of what happens to you. What do you want to tell me? What comes up right now?
Shame.
Thank you.
My father. He would spank us and take a belt to us.
Who did you speak to about your pain?
Nobody.
Yeah, that's the trauma. In other words, by the time you're 5 years old, you're completely alone. People are much more lonely and isolated than they used to be. Literally, it causes inflammation in the body and suppresses the immune system. You've been diagnosed with prostate cancer.
Correct.
In my view, people that develop cancer have a hard time expressing healthy anger.
Clinton versus Donald Trump. There were two traumatized people fighting to govern a traumatized world.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And these are the people that our society rewards with power. Our schools are full of kids with learning difficulties, mental health issues that are trauma-based, but the average teacher never gets a single lecture on trauma. We need trauma-informed medical care. Trauma-informed education. If we had a trauma-informed society, we'd have a society that looks much more compassionate.
You did. You made a difference in my life.
Thank you for being in touch.
I don't feel like I'm a bad person anymore.
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, I just want people to see the truth. Solutions arise out of people when they confront themselves with the truth, when they're not afraid of the truth.
I think the biggest thing that this whole healing journey has taught me
is how to be human.
That's the trailer for the film The Wisdom of Trauma, featuring our guest, Dr. Gábor Maté. He's just written a new book with his son Daniel titled The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I recently spoke to Gábor Maté. I began by asking him about the pandemic and the book's title, The Myth of Normal.
So the pandemic actually revealed to us how toxic our idea of normal has been, because it showed us the desperate need for human connection that we all have. But this is in a culture that has been isolating and atomizing individuals for a long time, where loneliness has been an epidemic for decades. It showed the noxious effect of racism and inequality, because the people who had the greatest risk for being affected by COVID were those of lower social class and of people of color. The normal that we came from, in my perspective, was already a toxic normal. We don't want to go back to it, because my contention in this book is what we consider to be normal in this society is actually neither natural or healthy. In fact, it's a cause of much human pathology, mental and physical, and actually people's pathologies, what we call abnormalities, whether it's mental or physical illness, are actually normal responses to what is an abnormal culture.
And Dr. Gábor Maté, you say in the book, in fact, that there are no clear lines between normal and abnormal. Could you explain what you mean by that and how you understand the spectrum along which these things lie?
Well, the key here is trauma. Trauma is a psychological wound that people sustain. And I'm saying that in this society, most of us, because of the nature of the culture, the way we raise children, the way we have to relate to each other, the very values of a society are traumatizing for a lot of people, so that it's false to say that some people are normal and others are abnormal. In fact, we're all on a spectrum of woundedness, which has great impact on how we relate to each other and on our health.
And Dr. Maté, explain how you understand, as you say in the book, that the term trauma has Greek origins, but that it's come to mean something quite different. I mean, in the Greek origin, it referred to a physical injury or a physical wound. But in psychiatry, in the work of Freud and psychoanalysis, in medical literature, generally now, trauma is understood as a wound to the mind.
It's a wound to the psyche, to our emotional being, and to the soul. And trauma is not what happens to us. People, when they think of trauma, they think usually of catastrophic events like a tsunami or a war or parents dying or sexual or a physical emotional abuse of a child. These events are traumatic, but they're not the trauma. The trauma is the psychic wound that we sustain, and our psychological traumas have lifelong impacts. And in my medical work, I found that psychological trauma, woundedness, underlies much of what we call disease, whether autoimmune illness or cancer or the various mental health conditions. And in our society, psychological woundedness is very prevalent, and it's a rather an illusion to believe some people are traumatized and others are not. I think there's a spectrum of trauma that crosses all layers and all segments of society. Naturally, it falls heavier on certain sections, on people of color, people with genders that are not fully accepted by society, people of economic inequality who suffer more from inequality, but the traumatization is pretty general in our culture.
Gábor, I was wondering if you could take some time and talk about your own journey from trauma and how it shaped you as an infant in Nazi-occupied Hungary to where you are today, and how that has influenced who you are.
Well, you know, the first chapter of the book opens with my arrival home to Vancouver, where I live, from a speaking trip. And I'm feeling really good about myself because it was a good trip. My talk was well received, and I had a good flight home. And when I arrived back at the airport in Vancouver, I got a text from my wife saying, "I haven't left home yet. Do you still want me to come?" And all of a sudden my mood switches. I become dark. I become angry. I become withdrawn. I become sullen. And when I get home, I barely even looking at her. Now, what actually happened here? All that happened was that my artist wife, typical of an artist, was in the middle of creative flow in her studio, and she forgot that her husband was arriving home at the airport. What was triggered in me, however, was the wound of a one-year-old infant who was abandoned by his mother in an effort to save my life, actually. But the meaning I made of it is that I wasn't lovable, that I wasn't wanted. And even 71 years later, when this woman who I'm relying to be there for me doesn't show up, the woundedness of a one-year-old infant shows up. And that's what my friend Peter Levine calls the tyranny of the past. And so these early wounds, in my case, this sense of abandonment, could still show up 7 decades later over a relatively trivial incident. And these early wounds of ours, well, or, so that's one way that it showed up. It shows up in my relationship to my work. So I was a workaholic physician for many decades. Why was I a workaholic? Because the message I got as an infant under the Nazis was that the world didn't want me. Now, if the world doesn't want you, one way to cope with it is to make yourself very important, become a helper, become a physician, because now they're going to want you all the time. But that's very addictive, because you keep trying to prove to yourself something you don't believe in the first place, which is that you're wanted. And so that the more people rewarded me with either financially or with their attention or their gratitude for my medical work, the more I needed it, the more I became dependent on it. So it shows up in so many ways. These early wounds show up in so many ways. It shows up in our relationships, in our marriages, in our relationship to our children, in our relationship to our work. It shows up in politics, as we've seen during COVID. So these early wounds in my life had wide-ranging implications, and as they do in the lives of many people.
Now, you've intrigued us because you said at the time you thought your mother abandoned you, but you, of course, now understand she was doing it to save you. Can you explain what happened?
Sure. So I was 11 months of age. My mother was a 24-year-old Jewish woman living under the Nazi occupation, under a viciously anti-Semitic fascist regime in December of 1944. And she found refuge in a safe home run by the Swiss embassy, but there were 2,000 people living there in a home meant for 100 people. The sanitary conditions were terrible. Food was very uncertain. And I was very sick, and she didn't think I would live. So she went out into the street and gave me to a Christian woman, a complete stranger, and asked her to take me to some relatives who were living under relatively safer conditions. Her intention was simply to save my life, and she did. But as an 11-month-old, I could only interpret that as an abandonment, because I don't understand the conditions. Now, who gets abandoned? Somebody who's not wanted. So I developed this fixed belief. Okay, I'm not lovable. I'm not wanted. Now, you don't need conditions of war and privation and such drama to give children the sense that they're not wanted. In this society, a lot of parents are advised not to pick up the kids when they're crying. That's enough.
Dr. Gabor Maté, the acclaimed Canadian physician and author who wrote the new book with his son Daniel, The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. And that does it for our show. To see all our interviews with Dr. Maté, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Mary Conlon. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, truck drivers. Here's a safety tip to know before you go. Give bikes 3 feet when passing. Don't pass if you can't. Help us keep New York City streets safer for everyone this holiday season. Visit nyc.gov/trucksmart.
A century ago, on November 18, 1922, Marcel Proust died. He worked feverishly in his final hours on his masterpiece, A la recherche de temps perdu, In Search of Lost Time. His 4,000-page novel is one of the most remarkable works of literature of the 20th century. During the war in Bosnia, I plowed my way through its 7 volumes, populated with 400 characters, not as an escape from the war. For the specter of death and the twilight of an expiring society haunts Proust's work, but as a way to reflect on the disintegration around me. Proust, like all great writers, gave me the words to describe aspects of the human condition I knew instinctively, but had trouble articulating. Proust understood